The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
So today I'm really excited. I've got my friend Alex from Weird Distractions here with me. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking about a case from Down Under, the unsolved murder of Betty Shanks.
Yes, I am so excited. Well, this case is one that's always kind of stuck kind of in my head ever since we covered it back in, it's since June of this year. And it's just a really odd case where there seems to be so many different theories, but no one has actually pinned down what it has exactly happened.
Betty was like a really interesting young woman too. I mean, she didn't come from a family that was like a wealthy family, but yet she seemed to be an academically high achiever for the time, because what was this, like 1951? And she just finished, she was 22, I think, and she just finished her psychology degree.
Yeah. And so she just landed, I believe it was a government related job. I was just actually watching a YouTube video that I stumbled upon, and I'll have to send it to you after. Completely forgot to write it down because what is keeping things organized in these days? As podcasters, you have like 17 different tabs open in your head. But I was watching this YouTube video and they actually explained what her job was. So she was responsible at one of the government buildings in Brisbane to kind of get people in to do the maintenance of all the different government buildings. And while she was doing this full-time job at the government agency, she was also expected to do night classes too. So she just graduated with a degree, I believe in honors psychology, work in a government job at 22, which, hello, that's amazing. And on top of that, she's also still taking classes. Like, she's still advancing herself. Yes, it's through her job, but still, like, she was really well-rounded based on what I read and remember.
And Betty was like supporting her family from what I gathered as well, right? Like, this wasn't somebody who was like living at home and like being taken care of by her parents. Like, she was looking after like her dad and wasn't like a younger sibling.
Yeah, so her dad actually had served in the war, and I believe he lost one of his legs, so he wasn't able to work. I don't really know about her mom's situation. I don't know if her mom worked or what have you, but Betty, she worked so hard because she, I almost kind of wonder if she knew she kind of had to support the family. She was the eldest child, and I think because of that, she might have taken on that responsibility. The family was getting a little bit of money from her dad's disability. However, obviously, as I'm sure you know, Jules, like, disability doesn't really pay much, right? Especially in the 1950s, I can't imagine it was anything substantial. So yeah, she went to school, and that actually inspired her younger brother, apparently, to seek post-secondary education, which that's, I don't know, it just warms my little heart to hear that kind of stuff. Because a lot of times, you know, when anytime you ask somebody, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up when they're a kid? You know, they say all these outlandish things. But I almost pictured this scenario where somebody asked Betty's brother, like, what do you want to do? And, you know, I want to go to school like my sister. And it's just, oh, it warms my heart.
It's so cute. And like, this family was obviously really, really intelligent. But there was something there was something else that Betty was really known for. And it seems almost ironic, given that we're talking about her unsolved murder. But it was that she was really, really lucky. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So she had won, basically, just to kind of summarize, like, the lottery. And I remember, I think it was like £3,000 at the time, which in today's money was, I want to say like 50,000.
It was a quarter million, around a quarter million.
Oh, yes, yes. So yeah, it was a lot of money. And so once she had won the lottery, it was released publicly that she had won the lottery, right? Which, I mean, in the long scheme of things, once you hear about the case and understand the case, it's like, ooh, maybe someone should have done a publication ban. But back then, I can imagine information was kind of shared freely without any concern that anything bad was going to happen. once Betty did get the money, from my understanding and my memory, she gave a portion to her parents to kind of help pay off the house, and then a little bit for them just to kind of be able to afford their means, right? And that also, I think, helped her through school as well.
Yeah, I think that Betty used the money for practical purposes. It wasn't like she was out there buying like a Maserati or something like that. And,
exactly.
And going on like fancy trips. Like, she was somebody who seemed to be really family minded, and she could, I mean, can you imagine at 22 winning like $250,000? I'd be like to my parents, maybe here's 10,000. I'm taking the rest. Yeah. I'm going on vacation.
Yeah, hope this $5,000 check works. Peace out. Thanks for all the support and, you know, life. But I've got money to blow.
Yeah, Betty was a better person than we are, clearly.
Oh yeah, 1,000%. 1,000%.
So when she went to go work at her job and she did these night classes, she had formed sort of a friendship with the instructor, right? And that the instructor would drive her home sometimes or drive her to the tram station.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember in our coverage of the case, when I said that to Christy was kind of like, interesting. But as far as my understanding, there was nothing nefarious about the relationship. It seemed strictly professional, but the professor, whose name is escaping me right now, but the professor would drive some students, including Betty, after class if they were kind of on his way home, which, I mean, today and, you know, in this year, I don't know if I would be comfortable doing that. But then again, we have so many true crime podcasts out there that it's like, well, you know, I've developed more fears of people, I think, in listening and indulging in true crime, that back in 1952 in Brisbane, it wouldn't have been an issue, right?
I don't think it would have been an issue, given the context that I think there was like less public transportation. So you've got a lot of people who don't have vehicles that are students and maybe put in a dangerous situation. So I think that the professor was probably just trying to be a gentleman, I'm assuming, and make sure that these people got home safely. So I think now we look at it with like the side eye, but I think given the time, it's not so weird as we would think today. Like, a professor being like, hey, ladies, like, I'll give you a ride home would be creepy. But then I think it was okay.
Yeah, that would, if a professor, you know, I'm just thinking of when I was doing my undergrad, if one of my professors said like, hey, do you want to ride home? I would have said no, thanks. And texted one of my parents, been like, oh my fucking God. You know what I mean? Just no, thank you, I'm good. But then again, you know, we're in such an age where we know how humans can be. And from, you know, what I remember of the case when this was kind of going on, you know, Brisbane was it was one of those places where, you know, you left your windows open at night, you left your doors unlocked, you know, you knew everybody. It wasn't this scary place that, unfortunately, I think because of the case of Betty Shanks, it slowly kind of went away from being so safe to not as safe, right?
Don't you feel like that's a true crime trope? Like, how many cases that we cover? And it's like, it would never happen in a town like ours. It was safe and we never locked our doors.
Exactly. Well, even so, Christy and I are from a small rural area in Ontario in Canada. And I remember Christy covered one of our town's most notorious cases, like one of the only cases we have. And right off the hop, that was one of the first things that we said is, you know, from Hanover, Ontario, no one's going to, like, it's such a small town. Everyone knows everybody. Nothing bad's going to happen, this, that, and the other. And then you hear about this horrendous case where this woman was, or this girl, she was a teenager, really. She went to the high school Christy and I graduated from way back in the 90s. And, you know, she was walking to school or walking home from school, and this random man just, you know, found her, assaulted her, and murdered her. And it's one of those situations where, because I think people always put that, oh, the true crime, murders, you know, homicide, like, all that stuff happens in the city, right? It happens where there's more people, because when there's more people, there's more problems. But in reality, it's, you know, it happens wherever you go, because unfortunately you can't control other humans and you can't control how they're going to behave or how they're going to act, right? So to kind of silo it to, oh, well, that's something that would happen in Toronto, Ontario, not Hanover, Ontario, it's silly, right? And I kind of forget, I had to look up actually the name of the case, which makes me really embarrassed because it's one of those cases I should know at the top of my head, but I don't. But yeah, it's one of those things where I think no matter where you go, there's always going to be that one case that kind of shakes up an entire area, right? Like, you're from Vancouver, correct?
I'm from the Okanagan. So I grew up in the Okanagan. Okay. So it's small as well. And like, I think that that's, it's like a false perception. And I think in a lot of unsolved cases, they're unsolved because there is no connection sometimes between the victim and the perpetrator. But statistically speaking, like you and I both know, and the listeners know, because I hammer this home all the time. But if somebody's going to hurt you, it's most likely that you know them. The boogeyman isn't some unknown person. They're typically somebody close to you.
Well, exactly. And a lot of times too, people think that every human being is going to act in line with society's morals and beliefs and rules, right? And of course, that is what we, I think, as a society try to focus home. It's, you know, you don't hurt your neighbor. You don't do this. You don't do that. You know, you protect one another and you should look out for humanity. But unfortunately, there are people in society that just don't. And I think those people are what really makes it hard for people to kind of realize, like, this could happen anywhere, right? And now that I've found the case, so we covered it back in this past March of 2021, and it was the case of Christine Heron. So that took place in Hanover, Ontario. So that's a really small town. Like, I think the population's under 10,000, right? But it was one of those cases too, where, you know, similar to Betty, it happened in a time where people didn't necessarily have any fears around, you know, leaving their doors unlocked or, you know, letting their kids walk home from school by themselves, right? It's unfortunate, but it does take those cases to kind of realize, like, oh crap, there are people out there that don't necessarily follow society's rules, put it that way.
Oh, and that's 100% true, because when we expect that of other people, we're also presupposing that in their lives, those adult figures, their mother and father, if they had both of those, would impart those morals upon them. Society does to a certain degree, but I think that we're making a huge leap. There's plenty of people that come from difficult circumstances that don't abide by the same, you know, code of rules, morals, ethics. So I think there's just so much danger out there in the world that we always have to be aware. But in, you know, the 1950s, when Betty was just kind of coming of age, she's 22. But one thing that really struck me about this story is Betty had like a schedule that wasn't fixed. She had a variable schedule in that, like, sometimes she was driven home, sometimes she wasn't, sometimes she would walk home at this time. And so if somebody was targeting her, like, this attack appeared as though it was targeted, because there was other women who came forward who said that they walked this path earlier, like they could have been the targets, but this individual chose not to target them. So the fact that Betty was targeted when she didn't know for sure if she would be taking the tram and walking the path at this point is really interesting, because there is that theory that it is a case of mistaken identity and that it was either supposed to be Ina Hamilton, who was, I think, like 35, but looked a lot like Betty. Like, even the bus driver thought that it was the same person.
Right. And that piece too really stuck out to me, because, you know, in general, the case is so, it does appear as if it is kind of a random act of violence in my mind. Like, that's kind of my own take on it. But it's interesting that some people have kind of taken it and said, oh, well, she must have had like a secret boyfriend, or someone must have planned this out. But realistically, Betty didn't have the same routine that, you know, Ina did, right? Ina, from what I remember, Ina had the same routine every single night. She walked home from work the same time every single evening, whereas Betty didn't. So the whole aspect of it being like a random act to me seems like the most logical, because someone could have maybe tried to attack Ina for whatever reason. I know there was at one point a theory that Ina potentially had witnessed a sexual assault or an assault an Australian soldier had done. And apparently some people have thought, okay, well, this Australian soldier is, you know, went to go attack Ina because Ina was there and he didn't want her to testify, this, that, and the other. And it's so out there. And when you actually look at it with a fine lens, it doesn't really add up. But I will say the similarities in Ina and Betty, they looked like twins, right? So if someone was to look at hurting Ina for whatever reason, who knows, maybe they saw Betty and thought, oh yeah, this is around the same time that Ina walks this path, this is Ina. But then you'd also think too, you know, if they started attacking Betty and realizing like, oh, you know, oh shit, this isn't Ina, why wouldn't they stop, right? It's so weird.
It's dark though. Like, it's possible that it could have been a targeted attack on Ina. And I looked at the pictures too, and there is a striking resemblance. Like, if you look at Betty, she looks older than her 22 years. I thought she looked, I don't know, 31, 32. She looks very mature. And I think part of it's what she's wearing and her haircut. But I don't know how deeply the police looked into Ina's life. And I'm with you on the whole her witnessing a sexual assault thing. I think that's a little bit outlandish. But that's not to say that she couldn't have had a stalker, because she ended up home 15 minutes earlier than she typically would have been that night. She would usually be on the path when Betty was on the path. So it is plausible that she could have been, that a perpetrator could have mistaken Betty for Ina.
Right, for sure. And, you know, let the whole... just going back to the Australian soldier thing, because that was one theory that we looked at, where apparently, I think it was on the east coast of Australia, there was a soldier who potentially did sexually assault somebody or was trying to sexually assault somebody. However, I don't know what exactly happened. I don't think they were ever charged, as far as memory served me. But people thought that this soldier, because of a marking found on Betty, had something to do with Betty's murder. And it's so hard to say, because there, with every theory of this murder, there are little pieces that kind of say, yes, this actually could work, this could connect. But then there are arguments that kind of pull you back, and it's like, well, are we just reaching, right? And when it comes to the whole police investigation, I mean, it was the 1950s. I'm not giving the police an excuse, but I think we're both aware that policing has hopefully come a long way since then. And I think, although some people say that the police did do a really good job at the investigation, I have a hard time not speculating that there might have been some not so great police work done. And the reason why I say that is because, from what I've gathered, police were approached by numerous people for potential leads. And depending on what lead it was, police might have said, well, that person's really popular in town, or that person's, I think there was one that was a doctor, and one police officer reportedly, allegedly said that, you know, well, he's a really good doctor, don't bother him, basically, which, point blank, that shit happened, right? And it's unfortunate, but it's one of those things where I just have a hard time believing that the investigation was maybe as intensive as it was. I think they did try and do a lot of door knocks and, you know, try to ask a bunch of people and did investigations that way, based on reports. But I just wonder how many leads they actually followed up on.
Yeah, they weren't used to investigating murders, period. Like, just from what we said earlier, like, this is a place where there isn't murders. And the fact that it's unsolved, we don't know what happened. So, I mean, they may have done the very best that they could at the time, given the skill set that they had. But I think by today's standards, it leaves something to be desired. And like, the second part of that mistaken identity theory would be her friend. Well, I don't know if they're friends, but they're sort of like, they knew each other, Marion, and they both wore red coats. And like, I thought it was kind of funny on that night. Marion, I guess, didn't like to always walk with Betty because Betty would like, I don't know, like lollygag about. She just like,
yes, she's like walk syndrome.
Yeah, she liked to smell the roses. And yeah, then we got Marion, who likes to book it. Like, I like to book it when I walk.
Same.
So I can imagine if somebody is slow walking, I'd be like, see you later.
Yeah. Either keep up or kick rocks. Like, we're making it home.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the time period too, right? That obviously Betty didn't feel unsafe. Even though it was evening, it was dark, she felt safe enough to be able to walk slowly and to just kind of like meander along. Whereas today, a woman who's 22 walking in a dark area trying to get home at night, she's going to be booking it.
Oh my, 1,000%. I mean, I still live in the same area that I grew up in, which is, you know, Great Bruce area. And there are times where I will walk out of a well-lit grocery store and I will hold my keys in my hands as if I'm expecting someone to come up behind me. And it's not that I'm trying to be abrasive, or I don't even know the term. Like, I'm not trying to say like, oh, I have to do that because of, you know, how unsafe the world is. It's just a response, and I don't realize it until I'm at my car and I'm trying to unlock the damn thing. And it's like, oh, well, my, you know, my keys are all in my fists and everything. But as some, like, I mean, as I said before, someone that does listen to a lot of true crime podcasts, that, you know, has heard of different stories, this, that, and the other, and being a woman, it's, you know, it's, it almost feels like a knee jerk reaction. Right. And unfortunately, back then, you know, you lived in an area, well, in Brisbane, where that wasn't a problem. So expecting someone to come up behind you as you're walking home and coming off the tram, not even a thought. You're just probably thinking of, okay, so, you know, I think Betty actually had plans to go out to the movies that Friday night, and then they got moved to Saturday. So who knows? She was probably thinking, oh, I'm going to go see a show tomorrow. And, you know, I wonder if mom and dad are waiting up for me, which they were. Right. And that's so devastating to think, wow, like, I wonder what was going across her mind. Probably, you know, nothing, no fears, probably no concerns. And yeah, it's just, it's heartbreaking to think that her last thoughts might have been simple and safe, and somebody took that away.
It's heartbreaking. Like, it just, they stole her innocence, you know, and it's one of those things that we learn, like, people speculate that she's having all these different affairs and there's married men. And then upon autopsy, they discover that Betty Shanks was a virgin. So I think that there's just like not a lot of credibility in these stories that are being told. People are just spinning a bunch of yarns. How long did it take for the police to take her disappearance seriously and to kind of jump into action?
So from what I gathered, basically, once her parents were kind of concerned that she wasn't home yet, I think it was like after midnight or something, that stayed up, or it was somewhere late in the evening, like late Friday night, early Saturday morning, they're like, okay, Betty should be home by now. They called her professor. The professor said, well, I dropped her off at the tram station, she should be home. I believe they called her friend at that point as well to kind of clarify, okay, were you supposed to go to the movies with Betty, this, that, and the other? And then her dad contacted the police. One of her parents contacted the police, I should put it that way. And then her mom had went out with one of the officers to kind of drive around and see what was going on, which I find is interesting because even today, you know, if you report somebody missing, especially an adult, you usually get the response of, you have to wait 72 hours or 48 hours. And are you sure they just haven't left to do their own thing or to go party? But it seemed as if police were like, oh, what? We got to get on this. That part was interesting to me. What are your thoughts? Because I know you've covered a lot of cases where it seems as if, I mean, in modern times, police are just kind of twiddling their thumbs like, well, we'll get to it.
I think, like, even when we look back at cases from like the 1970s and 1980s, it was like, well, obviously they went to start a new life. And it's like, yeah,
exactly.
They're 14. You know, they don't have any resources. It doesn't make any sense. And it was like this blanket thing for like lazy investigations. Like, we don't feel like looking into it, so we're just going to say that every person either ran away or started a new life, and like, you're never going to see them again.
It's, we're both just like, oh, it's, yeah. It's one of those things where I understand that police services are so, can be very overwhelmed, right? I mean, as someone that works in mental health, I understand how that can be similar, because if you don't have a full staff, you're screwed. Like, you are just dogpiled on cases and situations, this, that, and the other. But in the same sense, you'd think that that then speaks volumes to get more people on to look at these cases a little bit quicker, right? Or to have a designated missing persons team that actually can work quicker. But when it came to Betty, and I don't know if it's because, once again, it's Brisbane, it's safe at this point in time. I don't know if it, I mean, I'm assuming it's probably still fairly safe now. Who knows? Never been. But it was such a safe area that the second that somebody calls and says, hey, you know, my daughter's missing, we don't know where she is, she'd usually be home by now. At least if they could work a little bit quicker, or just even get people to have a quicker turnaround or a better protocol, right? Like, if there was like a worldwide protocol that we could have where every country, you know, within 24 hours, right? But I think because of Betty's situation, because she was from an area where none of this happened, it was primarily safe, they acted really quick, which is astonishing. And I wish we still had that.
Yeah, it seems to be really variable depending on where you're from, what your socioeconomic status is, what the social factors are. There's plenty of things that go into it today. But I think at the time, it was like, Betty is a respectable young woman. She's helping out her family. She's working. She's just finished her degree. So all of her social factors are saying that, like, this is somebody who should be back, not somebody who's going to be out partying.
Exactly.
When the police finally discover Betty's body, it's an interesting scene and a really brutal one. But like, the yard that she was found in, it was at a lower elevation, and the fence, that kind of fence in this yard, was really low. So it was speculated in a bunch of sources that she was pushed over this fence into this lower level yard, and it kind of like threw her for a loop. And then this person brutally attacked her. So what was the scene like?
It was brutal. And I remember one specific part that always stood out to me. One of her teeth had been, like, she had been kicked with such force that one of her teeth was protruding out. It almost was presented, like, her body was presented as if it was a sexual assault, which it wasn't. You know, she had her arms spread out. I believe her blouse was up. Her tights were lifted down. I believe her underwear was left on.
They were off and they had urine on them.
Yes, that's what it was. And her bra had been like pulled at, basically. It was brutal. It was, I remember when I was doing my notes for the case, I had a hard time. I mean, I listened to a lot of murder stories, right? So I've heard a lot of really twisted stuff, but I think because of her age and because of how her background was presented, this one was really hard to write, because a lot of the resources I used did use graphic detail. And I think when I even presented the episode, I tried to like limit it back a bit, because as much as I wanted to tell the story, it's like, okay, I sometimes get too mindful about that. But regardless, it was a brutal scene. And another odd part that kind of stood out to me was there was a print found, I believe it was her forehead, like kind of between her temple and her actual forehead, where it looked like a boot mark of sorts, I think it's called a gator, if I'm not mistaken. And
yeah, isn't it like people kept saying that it was like a boot that had been rehealed or something like that?
Yeah. And that kind of boot was worn by Australian soldiers at the time. So that kind of loops in the whole Australian soldier theory, right? But then you have this other theory where it might have been a hit and run situation, right? I know some people speculate that she was potentially hit by an officer by accident, and that she was like thrown over the fence to, I don't know, disregard her body, basically, disrespectfully, let's be real. And then this officer had went back after and then staged her, or was checking to see if she was still alive. Apparently she let out a moan, and then supposedly this officer realized, oh crap, she's still alive. So then unfortunately murdered her. I believe they speculated it was strangulation, and then made it look like it was a sexual assault, which of course, after the fact, as you had mentioned earlier, it was determined that, you know, she wasn't sexually assaulted based on the DNA evidence.
Okay, so everything you said, there's a lot to unpack here. First, yes. Let's go back to the sexual assault, like quotations. I don't know what I make of this. And for one, there's also the two attack theory. I also don't know what I make of that. But the sexual assault part, the fact that her underwear is pulled up, the fact that the urine-soaked underwear has been taken off, that doesn't necessarily, to me, dismiss a sexually based motive. Just because somebody wasn't able to rape her doesn't mean that it wasn't a sexually based offense. We don't know if this person ejaculated elsewhere. We don't know if they were unable to get an erection. It doesn't mean that just because somebody wasn't penetrated that the motive wasn't sexual. It could have been staged to appear sexual, but I think it's equally possible that it was sexually based. Because out of her purse, like her whole purse wasn't missing. It was just like her wallet was missing, but there was money left behind, right?
Yeah. And it was odd because, like, speaking of the items missing, because there is another theory that it was a robbery gone wrong, so to speak, right? But she had a watch on, and the watch was worth money, I guess. And whoever attacked her didn't take the watch. There was also, I believe, a piece of jewelry that was actually worth quite a bit, and that wasn't taken either, right? So that theory didn't really stand out to me. What I will say, though, and I do agree with you, I think it's hard to say whether or not it was or wasn't a sexual attack in any way, shape, or form, right? Because I think as a society, we hold so much hope on DNA and like physical evidence that we sometimes forget that just because there isn't doesn't mean nothing happened, so to speak, right? I mean, we want proof. We want to make sure that we have factual information that can back it up. But I also have a hard time believing that, you know, someone went to that great measure to stage it like that, like to stage her body like that and to tear apart her clothes, and no one heard anything.
In 1951, too, like forensic countermeasures like that, it just seems like a bit of a leap.
Exactly. And, you know, I wonder if, you know, it's one of those maybe situations where maybe it was an attempted sexual assault, but because, you know, someone maybe couldn't get an erection or what have you, that maybe this person got frustrated and that's how she died. Do you know what I mean? Like it was kind of a retaliation out of frustration, which unfortunately we've come countered with those cases before, right? It also is interesting because to me, it's at this point, I don't think anything can be ruled out. And I think that's also why there's so many theories, is because the older this case gets, the more ideas come out and the more people kind of take a new look and new perspective at it. But yet nothing's really changed, which is really frustrating.
Okay, so what do you think about the two attack theory? So I've heard some people say that because of what the neighbor had said, but he's also fell under a cloud of suspicion due to his timeline, right? Like he Yes. listened to a radio program and he said that Betty had, or he had heard a moan that it was after his radio program. It was like, what, like 10:20 or 10:30 or something. And they were saying that like, this was an hour after I think maybe other people had initially heard screams, because there was a bunch of ear witnesses in the neighborhood. Like, I think maybe like seven people or something who'd heard screams and nobody had called the police. And yeah, so his timeline made him a bit of a suspect. And that's one of the theories. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So he was an interesting fellow, and I don't have his name. I mean, I have my notes right beside me. I'm trying to look at them without making too much paper noise. But essentially, he was kind of suspicious because this neighbor, not only was his timeline not matching up with everybody else in the neighborhood, but he had an interesting background. So I believe he actually served in the army as well. And because of that, they're like, so you would have had access to these gator boots that, you know, everyone's talking about. Right. And then there was something else too, where I believe he had maybe an arrest, or you know, he kind of got really invested into the case that it kind of seemed odd, but basically he was a recluse, right? Like, I think he really kept to himself. He really didn't try to say much, but it's just, it's interesting how his story was so different. And I remember there was one witness in the neighborhood who said that she had heard a scream, you know, a distinct woman's scream. And I believe the woman's quote was, as if someone was dying. So she hears a scream as if someone is dying, and then went back to reading her book and didn't call police, which reminds me of that like notorious bystander effect case, which
Kitty Genovese.
Yes, that's who it is. I was trying to think of it earlier. I was like, who is that? Like, I should know this by now, but it slips my mind so often. But it's one of those cases where it's like, why didn't anyone call any, like, why didn't anyone call the police? But I think because Brisbane was so safe at the time, no one thought anything of it, right? It was one of those things where, well, why would I call the police? The last thing that's going to happen is someone being brutally murdered or brutally attacked, right?
And I think we make like excuses and justifications for the things that we hear because we intrinsically want to believe that like no horrible things are happening around us. So I think we write off things that we hear. Like, I've in the past heard fights between couples, like in an old building that I used to live in, that I probably should have called the police. But at the same time, I'm like, it's fine. Like, you know, they always quiet down. It's not my business. You know, I shouldn't get involved. They sound like they're okay. And, you know, I was really young when I lived in this building, right? Like, I was probably like 19 or 20. And so I just didn't know what to do and what was the appropriate response. So I think you've got a lot of people that are like, okay, well, the screaming stopped. Maybe she's okay now. Rather than the screaming stopped, maybe she's dead or maybe she's dying. Right.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, as much as I think sometimes we try really hard to think how we would respond in that situation, I think there's always room for, okay, but we don't know, right? And I think I've said it a lot on our show, and I think I'll always kind of say it, until you're in that situation, you really don't know how you're going to handle the situation, right? It's kind of like, until you're given that situation, you don't know how that's going to change your perception. Like, I know on Weird Distractions, we talk a lot about like paranormal conspiracy theories, that kind of stuff as well. And in doing this show, I've really realized that as humans, we will never understand, like we try to understand, but we'll never fully understand someone else's perspective. And I think until you're given a similar situation as somebody else, you just don't know how things will actually play out. And unfortunately for Betty's case, you know, it was one of those situations that costed her life because somebody else just didn't think anything of it, which, I mean, to that person, it's kind of fair, right? Like, Brisbane was so safe. And the last thing that probably would have happened was a brutal murder of a 22-year-old.
One of the most compelling theories for me personally, like, there was eyewitnesses who saw a man in a brown suit in the area that night. And there was a guy named Eric Scarry, and he was a guy who had a lot of mental health issues. Like, I think some of the diagnoses in 1951, like, I can't remember one of the things he was diagnosed with, like anxiety, hysteria.
Yes.
I think he was called a psychopath at one point. He had experienced psychosis, and he had a family. He was married. He had kids, and he was apparently obsessed with Betty. Like, I think he did some kind of contractor work around the home after they'd won the lottery winnings. So he may have been aware that she had won that money. And by some accounts, like his daughter being one of them, he had some kind of relationship or believed he had a relationship with Betty, which is more what I'm inclined to think. And later on, she came forward to the police, I think when she was like 16, and said that she was told to clean like human parts out of his car. Mud, which he thought was mud off of his shoes. And later on, a photo of Betty was found in a family album. So some people think that's like a trophy. What did you think of Eric Scarry as a suspect?
So first of all, when we did the episode in June, that name never came up in my research. And I don't know why it never came up, because now that I've heard about it, I am gobsmacked. Like, that, holy shit, that changes the entire narrative, right? As far as my understanding, he wasn't a well man by any means, shape, or form. And I believe there was a lot of abuse going on at the home. I believe he was abusing his daughter and his son quite often. And there seemed to be that weird kind of obsession with Betty Shanks. And I believe you're right. Like, I think he did some contract work at the home, but apparently he also worked on the same street that Betty worked. And often, I think they actually did meet at work, because from what I gathered in the one YouTube video I watched recently, he would do, I think, plumbing or something like that for the government buildings. So Betty was actually responsible to hire these contractors, such as him, to do that. And I remember one situation in particular where apparently his daughter and his son remembered that he had picked Betty up from work one day, and the four of them were in a car, and he told his kids to go to sleep, which, sir, I don't think that's how it works, but okay. I mean, I'm not a parent, so who am I to judge? But him and Betty then apparently got into this argument where they were kind of whisper arguing, and then Betty had reportedly proceeded to leave the car. Once out of the car, he follows behind her and then starts choking her. His son wakes up, sees the incident. I mean, it's, I guess it was dark out at this point in time, so the son, you know, probably in a daze, just woken up and everything, looks out the car and opens the door and says, "Mom," because, and this is so heartbreaking, but he thought that his mom was choking his dad was choking his mom, but it was Betty. And then Betty just left, right? There was another scenario too, where I think he had taken the kids to the museum, and there was a specific place about the that gave information about Betty and the unsolved murder, this, that, and the other. And apparently he had, like, squeezed his daughter's arm and said something on the lines of, you know, if you, I forget what it was, but this could be you or something like that. He could have honestly just been someone obsessed with the case. I mean, I think we unfortunately do have those people out there that get a little too invested in some unsolved murders and crimes, and to each their own. But just because of his prior history that we're aware of, like his mental health, the fact that he was quite violent, and the fact that he also served in the army. I mean, he was discharged, but he did serve in the army. To me, it's really interesting that, you know, I don't think police actually followed up with that case, by the way, that lead. As far as my understanding, so his daughter did come forward and said, "Hey, my dad, like, have you looked at this man?" And they kind of, from what I heard online, they kind of just told her, "Okay, well, that's nice, dear. Walk along," and that was it.
It's too bad, because so often we see young kids who've experienced such traumatic things. Like, we know the human memory isn't infallible. Like, we often misremember things. So can we rely on children who've experienced a great amount of trauma as being a reliable narrator in traumatic situations such as what these kids experienced? I could go either way with this case, right? Where he is just obsessed and he's been sexually abusing the kids because they obviously mm-hmm. had endured a lot at the hands of their father. And that's incredibly traumatic. Maybe he had nothing to do with it and was just somebody who was mentally unwell and very, very obsessed with Betty Shanks. Or it could be a situation where it's like the Black Dahlia and you've got the kids saying it's George Hodel. And it looks like it very likely could be, given all of the evidence that we have. So I don't know. I think he's the best suspect.
I agree. And to me, it just seems too obvious to look away, right? I mean, he worked near her. The man had a photo of her in the family album. Like, to me, it's like, you know, you could be obsessed with somebody, but that obsessed to have them in the photo album? And even, I believe his wife had even suspected it too, you know, that he had something to do with it. Like, that whole lead. And in revisiting this case, it almost makes me want to cover it again because of that lead specifically. Because as an engineer, I don't know why I didn't see it. I don't know if it was just, you know, hard because of the resources I was looking at or what have you, but it was never mentioned. So then when I heard about it, I was like, wait, what? Pardon? And no one, police didn't do anything? It just blows my mind. Like, to me, it just seems like an obvious thing. You know, why wasn't he brought into questioning? Why wasn't his DNA taken? Anything, really. Like, what the hell is going on? And that kind of falls back to, you know, did he have somebody in the police force, right? Like, did he have a friend? Or did they look into it quietly and then they just didn't find anything, but they haven't released that information to the public? Either way, there's some piece missing that just doesn't sit right with me.
This reminds me so much of the disappearance of the Beaumont children, which was also out of Australia. And all of the best suspects are suspects that have been raised by their own kids. And they're horrible, horrible individuals that have inflicted so much harm on their families. It's just, it's sick. When I researched that, it was early on in my podcasting days, and it was one of the hardest cases I've ever done because some of the suspects, like one of them I don't believe is a good suspect and he doesn't have any kids, wasn't raised by them, was Bevan Spencer von Einem. But reading into like his crimes was just one of like the low points in my research days because it was just horrific what he did to his victims. But I think you often got family members, and you see this with like the Zodiac too, right? Family members, yes. Or Jack the Ripper being like, it's my family member, or Zodiac, he's my, you know, grandpa or whatever. So I think we see people who go into it genuinely believing it, people who want notoriety. And I think in this case, the Sterry family, they genuinely do think that their father, Eric, had something to do with it. But the one part of it that makes me think that, like, how could he have done this so well and so organized? Is when we look at his mental health prior, he seems very disorganized and chaotic. And this almost seems like the work of an organized offender. Even what the kids are saying that he asked them to do, doesn't it?
It does. And that makes me almost wonder that. And that's why I think I have a hard time with that lead, because Eric does come across as someone who wasn't organized, very all over the place, you know. I don't want to say manic, but almost kind of manic by the sounds of it, and just scattered, right? Whereas the way that Betty had been murdered, it's hard to say. I mean, part of me thinks it might have been an accident, but the other part of me thinks, okay, maybe this was someone that thought it out, whether it was a stranger or someone she knew. I will say, with Eric's mental health being public, it's interesting that it A is public, because, and that this could be maybe just Australian policy, but you know, unless you've done something really bad, your mental health record should be under lock and key. It was a different time. It's a different country. I'm just speaking from, you know, specifically Ontario law. But the fact that we know his mental health is kind of interesting. It makes me wonder, well, if we're able to get it, like, did he do so? Like, is there a reason why we're able to attain it so easily? You know, it's a quick Google search, right? So It's interesting in that sense. And I will say, you know, someone with anxiety, it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't be organized. You know, I mean, I have anxiety attacks from time to time, or I can be a very anxious person, but my anxiety, it manifests more so in over organization. Like, it's annoying.
And you can see mixed offenders too. Ones that present as both organized and disorganized. And they everything that you think that you believe when you come across one of those offenders, it's like, okay, well, I thought that I knew, but I don't.
Yeah.
But I still don't know. With Eric Sterry, given his mental health and given that we know he spent time in psychiatric facilities receiving mental health treatment, as far as I know, he didn't admit this or confess to anybody. And somebody who's experiencing bouts of psychosis, it almost seems difficult for me to grasp, or all these years later, that somewhere along the line that he didn't confess this to someone, unless I just missed that detail and that maybe he did.
I mean, yeah. And that's the one thing too that is really hard for me to walk away from when it comes to him being a lead is, you know, okay, so either he got away with a perfect crime or there's something we're missing. right? I mean, even when we cover this case in June, this wasn't even a lead that I found. And I'm not saying that I'm like the world's best researcher, but I also am wondering too, if, you know, in bouts of psychosis, did he act completely different than how he typically presented, right? Like, was it kind of like a different presentation? So it makes you wonder, okay, because of his mental well-being being so up and down, because he did have obvious, I mean, pretty out there feelings about the case and about Betty, and based on the fact that, you know, there is a potential that they did potentially know each other. I keep saying potential because everything is up in the air. It makes me wonder if he did get away with it, right? Or if, you know, we just don't know, like there's something that either officials or whomever is gatekeeping that information just is holding back. And for what reason? Right? Because this is one of Australia's oldest cold cases. You think if someone knew something that could potentially solve it, they'd do it already, right? It just blows my mind. And that's why I think I could just be speaking on my behalf, but I'm assuming you'd also feel the same way. Is, you know, talking about unsolved murder cases is really frustrating because we like having answers and we like knowing who did what and why. But there's also a really rewarding piece that if you do cover and talk about an unsolved murder or like a missing persons case, that somebody out there who is holding on to that little nugget of information might decide to come forward, or they might know somebody who knows something, right? For example, there was another Australian unsolved crime that we covered, the case of Cheryl Grimmer. She was, I believe, 3 years old on the East Coast, and she had went missing and from the beach one day, and she was found. I don't think she was actually found, now that memory serves me, but regardless, you know, there's all these different theories as to what happened, this, that, and the other, and there's all these different leads similar to Betty, and yet it's still unsolved. And it's frustrating because it's like, oh my gosh, I just wish we knew. Right? We have no personal connection to these people, but just knowing would be nice so that we could, you know, say, yeah, this is what happened. And, you know, now we know, and now we can prevent situations like this from happening again. But because we don't know, it provides both like motivation to keep talking about it, but also frustration because it's like, someone's got to know something.
Yeah, I feel sort of the same way in that, like, I prefer cold cases because I like cases where there isn't a resolution, because in right. talking about it, you bring more light to it. And sometimes it's a case that's so old and the only justice that you can bring, because the likelihood of them solving it when there is no evidence left and everybody else who would be a suspect is dead, is you yeah. keep that memory of that person alive. And the more that you say their name, it's like a form of justice, and that their story and the injustice that was done to them is never forgotten.
Right. And that actually reminds me of a Macklemore song where I think he said something along the lines of, you know, you actually you died two times, like the day you die and then the day you die and then the last time somebody mentions your name. Right. And I think that's also, like, you're right, that's a good reason why we do cover these cases, is because although we don't have an answer, and although it's frustrating as hell, because, you know, it would be nice to come to a resolution of some sorts, talking about them also brings more attention to them and then keeps the conversation going. And then it kind of still feels like, as if, not that they're still around, because obviously, unfortunately, they're not, but that they're still part of a conversation somewhere. Right.
And I think oral history is a really powerful thing, right? It's something that transcends culture, race, religion. We all have a rich oral history that goes back, you know, I don't know, maybe millions of years, right?
Well, exactly.
Soon speech could be formed. I mean, we really know so little about history, right? We know what's been written in the books, but I think there's so much that we don't understand. And before there was a written word, there was oral history, and that was how you would pass down details. And I think the fact that you linked it to the Macklemore song is actually kind of profound. It's profound because you've got a situation where when people pass away, you think, okay, like they're gone, but they're not gone because their memory exists in the minds of others. And when you breathe life into them again, when you speak their name and when you tell stories about them. So when we're talking about the horrible things that were done to Betty Shanks, we're not letting her be forgotten. And I think that's the reason why, I mean, when it comes to more current cases, there's a chance that, you know, it might get to the right ear holes of somebody who's listening and they might have that information and you spread more awareness. So there's that. But when it's older cases like Betty's, I think the fact that she's still being talked about today says that she's never been forgotten, that there's lots of people out there who care what happened to her and would love to see justice done.
Exactly. And it's one of those things where, you know, I think no matter what, as long as the conversation keeps going, I don't see any harm, right? And especially if you're doing it in a way where it's like, we just want to know what's going on. This is what was last known. These are the theories that are out there. Like, what do people think? I think a lot of really good conversation can come out of that too, right? And I get frustrated because I'm one of those people that's like, I just want to know. I just want to know everything. I just want to know what's going on, who did what and why. But in the same sense, we have to also keep in mind that sometimes no answer is an answer. Right? Like sometimes not knowing is kind of knowing, because then you kind of keep talking about it. You get different ideas or you meet different people. You bring it up a conversation like what we're doing now, and you actually hear what other people think and get different insights. And then you can expand on that more. I mean, you know, who knows how long podcasts will be out there and like how people will be listening to podcasts 20 to 50 years down the road from now. But it'd be cool to know that somebody years down the road is listening to this episode and thinking, oh my gosh, I've never heard of this case, and then looks into it. And then who knows what they can bring to the table?
Yeah, I think those are all really great points. Yes. Alex, do you want to talk a little bit about your podcast, Weird Distractions, and where the listeners can find you on social media?
So yeah, Weird Distractions Podcast, you can find us over on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, Anchor. We're kind of on a bunch of different platforms. You know, I kind of pressed a bunch of buttons and ended up in a bunch of different places. So that's fun. And then we are on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook. Just trying to think of anything else. Patreon. Buy me a coffee. Honestly, if you, not that we're, you know, amazingly big, but if you Google Weird Distractions Podcast, I have Googled us before. We do show up. So that's kind of cool. And yeah, if you're interested in true crime, conspiracy theories, paranormal stories, folklore, just a little bit of this and that, I definitely would recommend checking us out. And I really appreciate this opportunity to get to talk to you, Jules, about this case, because it's one of those cases, like I said, it's stuck with me. And, you know, as I'm glad that you allowed for us to kind of continue the conversation and just to spend time with you, because we've never collabed before. So this is awesome.
Yeah, this has been a really, I always hesitate to use the word fun. Like when I say that, I don't mean fun in the sense it's been fun connecting with you. And yes. It's been enriching and enlightening talking about Betty's case and bringing awareness to that. Like, I never want anyone to think listening that we're like, when we speak about this, oh, it was really enjoyable. It's enjoyable being able to come together with another podcaster mm-hmm. who I consider a friend and being able to put out content for the listeners.
Yes. And I know sometimes Christy and I've had, like, we've had that discussion, because I'll say like, oh, how did you like that? And she's like, oh, that was good. Meanwhile, we talked about a horrible crime. And it's not that we're saying that the crime itself was good, but more or less that we're two friends talking about things that we want to learn more about and talk about, because, you know, the premise of our show is to get a distraction from everyday life. And the reason why we call it weird is because I know for me growing up, my interest in ghosts and true crime and this, that, and the other, like other, like people would look at that and say like, that's weird. You're into weird things.
Yeah. You're the weird kid.
Yeah. I was the weird kid. Right. And so a lot of that got suppressed in high school because I, you know, like everyone else, well, not everyone else, but
most people.
Yeah. Like most people, I try to be cool and hip and with the popular group. Right. And now as a 20 something, it's like, screw that. I love talking about this kind of stuff because I just like being educated about it. Right. And the more macabre things I get drawn to. So for me, it is a weird distraction because, you know, my work consists of most of my day. So if I can talk to one of my best friends and, you know, have our conversation record so other people can listen about all these different things, especially about unsolved cases or cold cases, why not? And, you know, I get that though. It's, you never want people to think that like what we do is fun, but what we're talking about, not so fun.
It's so true. So I'm going to link Alex's podcast in the show notes.
I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all. If any of you have anything to say about the case, any thoughts, you can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. Or I'm really, really active on Twitter. So please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story, and it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.